And welcome to this year. David has really lectured in architecture here at McGill University School of Architecture. My name is Aaron Sprecher, and it is an immense pleasure to welcome you tonight. Jürgen Meyer is with us tonight and will be introduced by Director Anne-Marie Adams in a few minutes. So it's time for me to ask you to turn off your cell phones and computers, to sit and relax and enjoy a beautiful evening. It is also my immense pleasure to welcome Principal Bernard Shapiro. From 1994 to 2004, Principal Shapiro shaped our identity as an internationally recognized university and a community of scholars who push the boundaries of knowledge every day. So it is with this image in mind that I am honored to welcome Principal Shapiro, who will say a few words about the legacy of Mr. and Mrs. Azrieli and the importance of this yearly event in the life of our school. So please join me in welcoming Principal Shapiro.
Bonsoir, chers collègues, chers amis. Je suis très heureux de me trouver ici ce soir, même pour les raisons professionnelles et les raisons personnelles. On the personal side, I really have two kinds of reasons for being here. One is simply to listen to the speaker, to Mr. Meyer. It's always exciting when you know you're in the presence of somebody quite special. Secondly, I'm here for the Azrielis. I've known Stephanie as long as I can remember, and as I've told her before, it was in the home, her childhood home on Roslyn Avenue, that I first learned to listen to chamber music. I can still hear the strains of Schubert's Trout Quintet and wondering why I hadn't listened to this kind of stuff before. I think it was due to her mother, who was playing it upstairs while we were at a party downstairs, but nevertheless, it's a memory that I hold very dear in my heart and have thought about ever since. David, I've known not for quite so long, a lot recently, but not for quite so long. And I'm happy to be here for him for two kinds of reasons. One is, it's really through him that I've learned to ask myself, I might have learned in other ways, I just didn't, I've learned to ask myself what the role architecture can play in society more broadly speaking. And that's something that's just a continuing interest. But secondly, I'm glad to be here for David as a fellow member of both the Orders of Canada and the Orders of Quebec, but mainly because I see in David a man who's built a dream. Many people have dreams. Now, of course, in architecture, build has more than one meaning, but nevertheless, a man who's actually succeeded in building, not only succeeded in building his dreams, but continuing to have dreams and to build upon them. You know, building dreams sounds easy, but it's not. And let me move to, therefore, the professional reason that I'm here. I'm here really representing the university, representing my successor, Heather Munro Bloom, and the chair of the Board of Governors, Stuart Cobbett. And I want to say a few words about how important events like the David Azrieli Lecture are for the future of the university. McGill has a long and proud tradition of private philanthropy, and it is that philanthropy that has enabled us, as so many people have noted, both within McGill and without, to punch above our weight time after time after time and produce the great institution that McGill has become. We could never have done it without the founding of McGill itself almost 200 years ago, but the continuing efforts of the university to be at the front of the frontiers of knowledge. And it seems to me that David, in this context, stands in a line of a very proud line of very wonderful philanthropists who have enabled this university to move forward in ways it otherwise could not. It is a pleasure on all those personal grounds and professional grounds to be here this evening to listen to Mr. Meyer. Thank you.
Principal Shapiro, Mr. and Mrs. Azrieli, Aaron, friends, colleagues, visitors to the school, McGill students. It is my honor to introduce tonight's speaker and our 2012 Israeli lecturer, Berlin-based architect Jürgen Meyer. Founded 16 years ago, the firm J. Meyer H. Architect Studio produces work at an extraordinary range of scales, from modest artifacts like sunglasses and wallpaper to extensive urban environments, all beautifully engineered. The studio is a perfect illustration of what my colleague, Professor Aaron Sprecher, would call an all-encompassing practice. What distinguishes the multi-scaled outputs of this remarkable contemporary object-oriented practice is the emphasis on pattern, curve, and fluidity. As those of you who attended the interview session this morning will remember, Jürgen Meyer studied at Stuttgart University, Cooper Union, and Princeton University. His work has been exhibited at MoMA in New York and San Francisco. He has a long list of awards, especially for such a young architect, including the Mies van der Rohe Emerging Architect Special Mention, the Holcim Award, and the Audi Urban Future Award of 2010. He's taught at Princeton, Harvard, the AA, and Columbia, and other schools. In 2007 and 8, he was the first Europe-based architect to hold the Frank Gehry Chair at the Faculty of Architecture, Landscape, and Design at the University of Toronto. Jürgen Meyer's architecture is breathtaking. Of all the adjectives we might enlist to describe it, curvy, fluid, organic, daring, bold, oozing, tactile, big, crystal-like, repetitive, continuous, perhaps even Baroque, I think it is above everything else, an architecture of today. Like them or not, the Villa Duplikasse near Ludwigsburg, Germany, the JOH3 in Berlin, and most certainly the 2011 Metropole Parasol in Seville are contemporary icons. The proof? It's where popular musicians such as Juan Palma, Lex Luthors, and Antonio Romero choose to film their music videos. And like these giants of pop music culture, the ordinary citizens of Spain, too, have chosen Meyer's urban space, surely the most elaborate shading device ever imagined, which also harbors a museum, a market, restaurant, plaza, and a panoramic walkway, as the backdrop to both political protests and sports victories like the World Cup. Rumored to be the largest wooden structure in the world, the Metropole Parasol has been described as, quote, a forest of mushrooms welded onto a flying waffle. One might say that Meyer's Metropole Parasol, shown beautifully here in Dave Cameron's model, has become the Eiffel Tower of Spain in the sense best expressed by Roland Barthes when he said of the French monument, the tower attracts meaning the way a lightning rod attracts thunderbolts. In addition to its political seriousness, Meyer's work is also very playful. For me, as an architectural historian, it harkens back to the delightful Love sculpture of Robert Indiana of 1964, and the cartoonish sculptures and installations of Jean Dubuffet, such as the monument with standing beast outside Helmut Jans Thompson Center in Chicago, affectionately known to architects as Snoopy in a blender. Dubuffet's emphasis on a black outline and the unique profiles of Meyer's buildings silhouetted against the sky are what inspire these echoes for me, allowing the work to be both explicitly forward-looking and simultaneously and fashionably retro. This morning, we also learned of Meyer's intense interest in the chamfered corner, a hallmark of 1970s skyscraper architecture, and a particular favorite, I would say, of Montreal architects who worked at Expo. Welcome, Jürgen Meyer, to the home of the chamfered corner and to the School of Architecture at McGill.
Visible enough. Thank you so much for this great introduction, and also to see how lively, adaptable something, you know, as an introduction can be. We talked about this morning on the chamfered corner as something that might be the first step, like spline 101, as George Tissot tried to explain it in our discussion, where we see our work somehow on a kind of a continuous graduation or on the scale from kind of the 90-degree corner to a completely free curve architecture. Not so much that this is a question of, let's say, style or preference, but mostly it seems to kind of give a kind of a resonance to the context or elements of the context that we find on our sites when we propose our architecture. But in a way, for me, it doesn't really make a kind of a dialectic difference. It's just where you find your way on that scale from rectangular to freeform. But this is kind of off my presentation preparation. I'm showing work tonight that goes from 2D to 3D, that goes from small to objects on an architectural scale to urban, and that also shows you how the materiality of architecture needs to be expanded into new materials, new construction methods, and all of this comes with a kind of ignorance when we design how to build it later and catches us at the moment when we have to build it and make it material. But before I start and show you a lot of images, I also want to thank Steffi and David Asrielli for supporting this lecture and inviting me here, and McGill University to be back in Montreal. I was here as a student when I was at Cooper 21 years ago. It was in February. It was super cold and snowy, but also crisp. The light was quite similar. So finally, I made it back, and it was a great day today to look around. So everything kind of starts with a personal obsession, and maybe that's also one of the lecture's kind of messages I want to give you, that something that, you know, raises your attention or like asks for a certain curiosity, if you kind of are persistent enough and follow this, you know, you might discover a whole universe behind that initial eye-opening moment. I call the lecture Pretext Vorwand. Pretext is kind of the direct translation into German as Vorwand. Wand means wall, and vor means pre. So somehow it's a relationship between writing and architecture, or writing and text, and architecture and wall. And both of it, as our architecture, I like to see it as kind of a precondition. Our work seems to be more of a trailer of a future that might be possible to come, or kind of a proposal, more of a question than an answer, as these patterns that I show you here are all text and printed letters and numbers without actually having a meaning. Although they are very strategic, they talk about a situation between a before and behind. They talk about discretion and indiscretion, about covering and uncovering. These patterns are kind of created around 1900. You find them on the inside of envelopes, or you see them on multiple slips, multiple forms when you get your PIN number or your salary slip. And these patterns come in different variations. They started, I think, with letters. They now come as camouflage patterns, as company logos, as very free-form graphics. But they all have one intention, which is to create a kind of a boundary, or like a kind of a blurring layer between inside and outside, as in envelopes, between a kind of a private personal information inside and it's kind of a neutralized outside. It also becomes kind of a metaphor for things that we deal with in architecture, mostly the skin of a building, where it is about indoor, outdoor, inside, outside, personal, exposed, a public view and a private interior, and so forth. So this collection that I started in 1994, and maybe I have now 350 different patterns, this is what you see here, from like very kind of funky moiré effect pointed patterns to these are more camouflage-like patterns. All of these kind of collections show that there is kind of a graphic universe that does these separations, that are markations, like layers of negotiation between these different conditions that architecture always also has to deal with. It also kind of represents an idea of architecture as communication. If there is a space where we kind of get activated to use architecture not as a stable background, but as something that becomes a catalyst for an exchange of a cultural and social space, then these might be indicators, for me at least, where we have to talk about these boundaries and how these spaces get defined. Now, in what I'm showing today, you see kind of step-by-step interpretations of these patterns from 2D to like larger structures, and also how then from one building to another one, or from like one scale to another one, these elements also change meaning or construction methods, or how they're used in the buildings. In this case, it is an installation for Berlinische Gallery, which is the County Museum of Berlin, or the State Museum of Berlin, and it became a big kind of carpet printed installation where the building as it is, the space of the exhibition room, became kind of fitted with this pattern that is printed on a carpet and put into place. So when you're in the space, you kind of get immersed in this pattern. But what was more important were these small models that you see here on the pedestal, which is what you see here, a 3D plotted model, where the goal was, or the rule was, from one side, when you look at it straight, you would have the pattern, as you see it on the upper left side. But as soon as you turn around, it becomes a very three-dimensional complex structure. And there were five different models of five different patterns, all interpreted in a different way. But it was a move from a 2D to a 3D space. Exactly that layer of pattern, these are all found patterns from envelopes or shipping slips, where the space that is so flat when you get it becomes a three-dimensional inhabitable space. So that's that kind of layer of negotiation becomes actually the actual space itself. One larger exhibition, and this is kind of the background for a lot of work that I'm showing you here now, which sometimes is very directly a pattern interpreted and made larger. Most of the time it's more of a reference rather than a direct translation. Here it's a competition we won for Autostadt Volkswagen. It's basically the city, a themed city where you would go to buy your car, or you pick up your car when you bought it, or just go there to learn more about mobility and the different brands of Volkswagen. This exhibition here we designed is about mobility and sustainability. And we started with an idea of the recycling triangle that you see up there, which is such kind of a standard logo now for how we produce, how we consume, and how we move in our contemporary uncertainty, how to actually be responsible for our future generations. And this triangle becomes more and more kind of broken up and complex because now it's we understand that this kind of simple recycling triangle is not all we know about how to see sustainability. It is more of a dead-end road network structure where there are much more dependencies, interdependencies, and also dead-end situations. So this structure here shows that everything is kind of networked and dependent on each other and became this three-dimensional forest-like space with all these embedded information points and exhibition spaces. And it opened about 2 years ago. Already they redo some of the contents of the screens, but also some of the elements are already replaced by other ones. So it's a kind of a work-in-process exhibition space that has about 3,000 visitors a day, and it has to work for somebody who's really interested in the theme and goes very deep into the content, or somebody who just walks through it and experiences more on, let's say, atmospheric or intuitional level. Here is an artificial waterfall. When you touch it, there are certain words that are created. So it's very playful, at the same time also very scientific. We started to work on an extension of it this year, which is a floor below. So if you can kind of consider the green as kind of the more, let's say, lush part of a forest, now we talk about the roots and the foundations. And this is now for the children, an age group from 2 to 12, to experience these kind of issues more on a playful level, on a motoric sensorial experience space. And this is now what is going to be realized until next year. This also becomes much more fluid, much more organic. You see parts of the level green exhibition on the upper, on the left side, while the lower kind of floor peaks up and shows this kind of connectivity. So it's a very playful, groundish space where these contents that are more scientific up on the first floor become adjusted and experimental for a younger generation. Also much more complex in its geometry because here it becomes really the object to discover and not just a display element as it is upstairs. On a larger level, this idea of this kind of artificial forest was explored in a dining hall outside of Karlsruhe at the very intersection of the city and the forest. And here it becomes a student center, which is not really something that is a tradition in German universities, but more and more, I think also German universities understand that student centers are a real melting pot of ideas, exchange, communication. And it also is more kind of efficient because they closed down three smaller dining halls and created this larger one. This one here, and you see it where the light spot is, there's the castle, which is the central point of Karlsruhe. You see it on the left, on the right side. It's a very radial city, and basically at the last radial axis, you have the dining hall, and then the forest starts to the north. This kind of this ambiguous situation where the building sits also asks for a kind of elastic understanding of the building, and it was a very tight footprint for the program that they wanted to have on that site. So we developed a kind of a diagram that we called Nutellagram, where you have the floor and the ceiling and kind of an elastic space in between. And as long as you kind of the program was fitted in, you know, the relationship was constantly changing, and then it was kind of frozen. And then kind of reinterpreted in architecture. So what you have in the south side, which is more open and public, it becomes more of a skeleton space, and in the north side, it becomes more squeezed and thick and kind of closed. So it is a nice transition from like a more enclosed building with walls to a more open kind of public part of the building. These are the spaces, and you get an idea of a continuity, which is a floor, a wall, and a ceiling, or a structure that actually encloses you rather than being kind of tectonic and put on top of each other or like shows the separation of things, which seems so easy when you look at it. You know, you just kind of paint everything. It actually means quite difficult detailing behind that colored surface. So on one part, it's a drywall with a paint on the floor. It's a polyurethane that has to be very durable. Then it turns into a different kind of polyurethane, which has to be diffusion open for being on a wood, applied on a wood surface. So what looks also kind of continuous in the end actually is a very precise detailing and an addition of different parameters on each wall and in each kind of dimension. But it was important for us to create all these kind of perforating views and relationships between inside and outside, or production and consummation of the food. And this also then creates very beautiful windows. In this case, it's the main office window that looks onto a soccer field. The program is very kind of efficient. We were asked to provide at least 1,800 meals a day, and they're already up to 2,700 because it's so successful and so kind of welcomed by the students, which use it not only for the dining moments but also a real student center where they go and meet and work and hang out. But what was the real innovation in this building, and that's what I was mentioning a little earlier, being kind of ignorant in the design phase meant that we had to be super innovative when it came to building it. And there was a very fixed price, a very kind of limited budget for public building in Germany, which usually asks, I think, for a box and some windows in it. Here, we had to struggle for about 3 months to find a way to construct this and make it possible within the budget. So we invented a timber construction with a polyurethane coating that is completely new and prototypical, and now became the prototype or like an example for sustainable building in Germany. But we had to fight a lot of accusations from architects for many years who said, oh, you can't do that to wood. You know, if you build with wood, you have to show the wood. Nobody asked that about concrete today or about steel. Well, this polyurethane is not really doing well for the wood. It's going to rot underneath and so forth and so forth. Now it sits there for 6-7 years, and all these voices became completely silent because it really sits still there as a beautiful building, and it works. And it has a lot of good things also. It reduces the amount of wood because you don't need the 2 centimeters of wood weathering protection for the wood. And also, you don't have to repaint it every 2 to 5 years, which you would usually have to do when you have an exposed wood surface. So all these things, not only in the construction process, but also in the maintenance, became quite interesting. Also, the construction period was reduced because it's all prefabricated. You bring it on site, you fill in the corners, and then it's sprayed on with this two-component polyurethane 3-millimeter layer. And that kind of seals the whole building. There's no metal flashing anymore. It's basically all that one skin, all the detailing happens underneath. And then you set in or you put in the windows and become kind of the jewels in that continuous surface of indoor, outdoor. And even when it has these areas where rain kind of falls onto it, like the lower parts, you still have the same kind of surface. And that's usually what we hear in our buildings when we publish them, that they say, oh, it's a nice rendering, but that's the way how it looks when it gets built. And I think it's exactly this kind of missing detailing that you would expect, like the metal flashing at the edge of the building on the top, or a different kind of materiality on the lower parts where you can sit down because that's kind of exposed to water. But this new material actually makes it possible to cover all these areas. On a larger level, this is a courthouse in Hasselt in Belgium. You might know it. It's a competition we won also in 2005, I think, and it's now close to be finished. The outside is finished, the indoors are on its way, and I think it should be opened in November this year. It's on the master plan by West 8. You see here the site. It's next to the main train station. There's a park, which you see a little bit right, upper right from the building. And there are a couple of more buildings to come. One of the references for this project were also trees. In this case, it's the hazelnut tree in the logo of the city of Hasselt. So Hasselt came from hazelnut trees. Did you know that? Yeah, it's really beautiful. And so also a tree is like in old villages, like the central tree in the villages where the kind of the citizens sat down and spoke justice. So the tree also is kind of a symbol of a reunion or a union and a gathering point and also a crucial point in speaking justice. Then there were also other references. The city has kind of two high points from the Middle Ages, which are the two Gothic churches. Then you have the two towers from the 60s, from last century, which was the technical town hall. And now the new development also asks for two high points. So there are kind of this history of the two-ness in the silhouette of Hasselt. So this is like the study we made. There's one tower and the other one, which is part of the courthouse. The courthouse is built, and the other tower will be built by somebody else, but we don't know who that will be because our building is the first one now in the development of this whole new master plan. In this case, it's the same wood, but only the facade is held up by this layered Kerto timber construction. And in this case, also, the wood is exposed in a second layer, which is not the carrying one. So you get a much more kind of natural feel and materiality that actually is closer to the idea of the tree itself. And we needed a double facade with a shadowing device, a perforated metal for sun protection. But this is how it sits in the city. Quite a scale jump, but you have to imagine that the same, like the base is like a height of 6 stories, and you have similar height buildings on the left and the right. So it will be, in the end, a continuation of buildings in that scale along the new train tracks. On a smaller scale, but also with the same idea of these double windows and the perforated facade, this is a office building in Hamburg. It sits on the waterfront, you see it here. Hamburg is beautiful because it has these inner city lakes, and water is a very kind of dominant element. In this case, it is a kind of a forgotten area of downtown Hamburg, and with this one, it became a generated improvement of that neighborhood. You see how the building sits alone by itself at this point. Right now, everything around is already built. But it was kind of a generator for a reconsideration of that part of Hamburg. So the building is a kind of a straightforward office building, but every part that's a rental unit, you have these kind of eyes, these winter gardens that you can step into the facade, get fresh air, maybe have a cigarette or read something, you know, but it's kind of a way to step outside of the building and then come back in again. So this is maybe 50 to 7 centimeters of facade that allows you to have this flexibility in a speculative office space in this case. And also the public park in front of it was redesigned by us. The client offered the city to also improve that design. And for his investment there, he was able to build a little bit more square meter. So that was an interesting give and take from the city and our investor. The plan is very straightforward, and that's what I said before with these eyes that you see in the facade. There were moments of like specialness within the flexible floor plan, where it could be a meeting room or a special lobby or a different kind of use moment of attention in that open floor plan. This is how you would step into the facade. But the idea of this kind of perforated relief facade also goes into the interior. It articulates itself in the separation walls and also in the construction when you see the prefab concrete floor, ceiling and floors that kind of echo the same language and the furniture and so forth. This is the meeting room, and you would look outside onto the water. But when you look outside onto the park, you get these elevated grasses. And as the eyes or these kind of winter gardens are special moments in the building, they become special moments in the garden, like kind of picnic areas where you would sit during lunch break. And so you have this nice echo of garden and landscape and the building. And this is something that you see a lot in our work, that we don't stop with the building. It actually continues out into the kind of landscaping or the urban space design as much as it goes into the interior. Another green grass project is this Villa Duplicasa. And it is named Duplicasa because it duplicates a house that is sitting there, was sitting there before. But also it kind of duplicates, similar to the dining hall where we have floor and ceiling. It's actually the lower floor, which is the private floor, and the upper floor, which is the private floor, and the mediating floor in between, which is the more public area in a house. This client came to us and said, oh, we have this building here. We started to build our home in like 1984. We extended it with every, you know, child we had, you know, we made a lot of transformations. So we are emotionally very attached to it because it's kind of building our family history. But we don't really like it anymore. Like, it's so kind of messed up and, you know, it doesn't really work. And we need something new, but we still like the old one. So this is how the old one looked. And you can see, like, I mean, in color, it would be even more telling. You can see there is, like, every material that was in fashion in the last 20 years, you find, you know, from dark marble to light marble to every granite you can find to travertine, and the balcony became a window garden, became an extra room, and so forth. Even the addition of the Tadao Ando-like garage on the right side, all of that kind of is a collection of what happened in the last 20 years. So we said, okay, since we have to keep a lot of the concrete of the basement on site anyway, why don't we call it family archaeology? So we kept the original footprint of the house and started with that one as our originating geometry. So we duplicated it, we rotated one out of the other. Then, of course, every floor kind of had its own dynamic with the children's rooms and the parents' room, and they all kind of got then, you know, fine-tuned. But in the end, this is what was the generating geometry, and this is how it sits here now. It's the River Neckar, which is near Stuttgart. Across from, like, the lower right side would be the Chipperfield Schiller Archive, which is our national literature archive. And we were lucky because the site is next to the old production factory of the client. So the site actually is an industrial site rather than in comparison to a declared housing site, which you see a little bit further to the left. If that would have been the case, then we would have to make a pitched roof with like red tiles. But since this is an industrial site, we were quite open and flexible with the regulations. So this was kind of the lucky moment of the project. So the outdoor pool was there already, just kind of the surfaces changed. The stone walls that you see on the left, on the right side, they were there already. So there's a lot of like found elements that have been here. In the end, it's this whitewash that all kind of glued things together. And here you see these two layers, the lower level for the children and the swimming pool, the upper level for the parents and guests, and then in the middle you have the kind of public areas of the house. And what looks so, again, simple as this one white blanket of the building is a super complex detailing behind that white color. You have a wood attic with a polyurethane coating. Then you have a white stucco. You have polyurethane on concrete, on lightweight, like, I don't like, Leichtbeton concrete. How is it? This? Porous concrete, whatever, stones, which is around these kind of curved openings, becomes stucco again, and it turns into a tartan rubber floor in the grass. So all of this kind of white continuous surface is an addition of very different complex detailings behind that white color. Here are some of the plans. You see a lot of walls from the old building extended with our new geometries. This is the main floor with a central atrium and four big spaces separated by cores, and the upper floor all around the central atrium. So the cantilevers come from this rotation that one floor is actually rotated out from the other. And there's a certain symmetry that you can see where the lower part of the upper floor and the upper part of the lower floor is all the same dimensions. The windows are the same dimensions. The black strip on the at the top is the one that's folded at the bottom. So there's kind of a horizontal symmetry in like design decisions for these areas. And some interior views. This is the dining room. We were able to only go inside and take pictures before they moved in, so like a week before, and we have some furniture to get an idea of the scale. I don't know how they live in there now. Like, we were not able to go and see it since then. They seem to be happy, at least that's what they tell other people. So this is on the other side, the literature archive in Marbach. But it's also important when you explore certain ideas. Thank you. Of housing. This was a single family house, of course, in a very kind of upscale version, but there were some kind of also landscape ideas that you see in the outside, how the building sits on the sloped grass. On the other hand, also in the inside, you have some of kind of stepped areas. And this is something that also came back in an apartment building that we just finished in Berlin. This is in the center of Berlin, next to a Baroque building that you see on the right side. A rendering and now the realization. This is an anodized aluminum facade with these kind of fillets, lamellas that take a certain kind of relief or three-dimensional idea of a facade, a stucco facade in a contemporary way. We wanted to build a house that is completely transparent and yet offers a certain kind of privacy to the people who live in there. Berlin is very typical as kind of front house, like a block that has a kind of a complex green, whatever, big green kind of reality in the courtyards, and then it's kind of a closed court towards the street. And we wanted to bring this kind of green nature idea of the courtyards into the building and make it kind of livable, as, and then it kind of swapped also onto the street facade. So it's kind of an echo of what happens in the backyards. This is also a very typical layout. You have a front house and a side wing. You see that kind of happens in a lot of these buildings in the neighboring slots as well. The kind of the terracing of the building from the courtyard up into the building shows in different forms of the private gardens that move up and then also into the terraces of the apartments. And you see these sunken areas that also happen to be this kind of living room so far. Maybe 70s ideas of hanging out. And this is kind of an abstracted ground floor. So what I said before, that there is a transparent building that also creates a certain form of privacy, this is how the idea of the lamella started. When you are in the backyard, you would have kind of a lot of light, or you want a lot of light. At the same time, if you have a perpendicular view towards your apartment, you also want to have kind of a visual kind of barrier. And this is how these lamellas started. And there is, of course, a certain, let's say, limitation of what you can see and what you cannot see that we explored. And this is kind of a diagram of kind of exposed and intimate. These are the sunken areas in a diagram. Here is the view for the backyard. In some areas where you have these lamellas that actually cover the whole facade, you might have a bathroom or a sleeping room behind. So that became important in this context. And then this is very early planting ideas. Now already like the ivies go up, and it's much more green already. These are sunken areas of apartments that before they moved in. And this is, again, the main facade with the entry into the building. On a larger scale, this is a competition we won a couple months ago in Düsseldorf. It's also something we would like to explore in a high-rise building. This is the light point on the left side. The other one on the right side I'll explain to you in a second. It sits on the River Rhine. It has a view towards the south to this Rhine Valley, but also towards Düsseldorf, the main city center. And you see here the building at the corner. It's a high-rise for about 70 meters high. The lower floors are for doctor's offices and a private hospital. It's next to a public hospital. There's a whole housing development that you see on the right side, and these kind of villas that go towards the river. We won the competition for the high-rise at the corner. And what is interesting about this project is that it actually has these kind of mixed-use functions, but also we wanted it to be kind of a reference to the River Rhine and the fluidity that you actually always have when you look outside. It's complex in its different programmatic layouts. You have all the doctor's offices and the hospital functions in the lower floor, and then this kind of mix of apartments to the top. But we wanted, again, this kind of ephemeral skin that wraps around the building that becomes very kind of specific when it covers certain areas where you can look out, or like it creates a certain kind of, let's say, it holds you in the building. At the same time, you always have this view and this transparency towards the Rhine Valley. And this is where we are at this point. We hope to start construction in about a year with that one. But when you're up there, you look back at Düsseldorf, and I don't know if you know Düsseldorf, but it's actually a very interesting city, which was quite heavily bombed in the Second World War and became kind of a showpiece for contemporary architecture in the 50s and 60s with very special kind of architecture from that period. Since then, not too much happened. There's a famous Frangieri building in the harbor, but not many more kind of interesting contemporary architecture pieces. So the city now invites a lot of architects for competitions, and they would like to be back where architectural quality becomes part of their identity. This is the other high-rise that we won actually a year ago, and this is a more complex situation where we still have to go through the zoning definitions of the city, but this is going to start maybe in 2 years. And it's a high-rise on a 5-degree angle, as part of an new urban development compared to the other angled corners. We are kind of on the upper scale. This is kind of a doubled high-rise that comes out of a ring of a kind of a commercial building. There's a hotel. There will be different kinds of mixed-use programs. And it will be, I think, in the end, right now they talk about having a Japanese trade center there because Düsseldorf has a very strong Japanese community. You see, the darker ring is our project. The high-rise sits at the left side. The whole development actually was a competition that, in the end, Deluk and Meisel from Vienna won the urban planning scheme, and we got that part with the high-rise, and they're working on the other two courts that you see on the right side of it. But it will be interesting to see how this, again, starts to reactivate an area of downtown Düsseldorf, which it was a former post service or post distribution center, and that moved outside of the city, and it's a dead part of the city for many years. And I think these are very crucial points where we have to discuss, where we can discuss actually what public life means in these kind of urban areas. And the last picture of that one, you see the ring with the towers coming up. From all these kind of projects, which are still kind of defining a certain, let's say, object-like or kind of small-scale urban dimension, I want to jump into something that is about kind of creating a kind of a nation. And we are part of a new development that happened in Georgia in the last 5 to 7 years, and we became part of it about 3 years ago. Our projects are kind of smaller and maybe a little larger, but in the end, we are involved in maybe 15 projects. All of the dots that you see here are potential sites for our buildings, and it's like an acupunctural intervention into the country, and we are just one of many architects now being involved there to really change the image and change the idea how public life is organized and also shaped in Georgia. The first one I want to show you, and I'll show you a couple of them before I then go deeper into a definition of the Metropole Parasol in Sevilla, but all this is kind of a, let's say, the kind of the context where things discussed, issues that we discussed in the Seville project, which became kind of so kind of condensed as a incubator for what urban life in the urban century in the 21st century can be, was kind of tested or gets in segments also explored in other projects. So Georgia, which is a kind of a transit country from Azerbaijan to Turkey or from Asia to Europe, also is in transit right now to redefine itself from a post-Soviet country into a more Western-oriented society. And also the boundaries between this country and their neighbors have to be redefined. Batumi is one crucial port, but also becomes a hub for kind of tourism in that region. And the first building that got built from our buildings actually were built without us knowing about it. We did a couple of designs for kind of cafes and sculptures for Tbilisi. And then they contacted us for another project, and they said, oh, and then when you come, you can also come for the opening of the cafe. And I said, what cafe are you talking about? And they said, well, this cafe in Batumi. And I said, I don't know about a cafe in Batumi. Oh, okay, we'll find out. And so actually it turned out that from the five renderings and like very sketchy plans we sent them, they decided to build one of them. And they did. Here it is. It was a little bit of a surprise, and after this kind of bumpy start, actually, somebody liked it so much that they also echoed it on their facade in the back. The president, when I met him a couple of months later, said, well, it's kind of an honor. It's like a fake Rolex, isn't it? Like, it's good to be... So this was kind of the beginning of our relationship. But since then, there were a couple of other projects that really became a serious collaboration and discussion. And one important one is the border station in Sarpi. That's the border to Georgia. And it sits at the very edge of the Black Sea. Here it is. It is not so much a separation between two countries. It's more of a meeting point where we also designed, besides, of course, the checkpoint programs, meeting places, and, of course, there's also shopping, but there are conference spaces where you can actually meet and rent and have, you know, business meetings or cultural meetings. And this is also part of a kind of an easing, make it more easy to go from one country to the other. Like Turkish and Georgian people now just can go with their ID card. They don't need a passport anymore. And the idea of welcoming somebody rather than like protecting your country, I think also shows very much in this structure. It sits at the very beach, and it becomes quite visible and marks this kind of new understanding of Georgia as a country that builds. And you also see that it's part of a place where you can hang out. It's not a protection. It's nothing that wants to kind of make you afraid of something, but it's part of like the everyday life of Georgians. This is the building, and they already started to expand it because it works so well and the shopping goes well. Here you see the tower with terraces where you can watch out onto the lake, onto the sea, the meeting rooms that are sitting on top of the checkpoints. Here, the view towards the sea. at night, of course, it also creates a different kind of welcoming structure, and the silhouette kind of becomes an interesting kind of eye-opener. What's interesting that about Georgia is that they understand that transit also means that the architectures that you see along this kind of transit from the checkpoint through the highway that they're building now to like leaving the country again might become the only kind of visible architectures while you go through a country. And it's amazing to see somebody taking care of those kinds of infrastructures as being part of an architectural discussion. Another project that happened very rapidly is a small airport in Mestia. Mestia is up in the Caucasian Mountains, which is a World Heritage Site. This is how we landed. I think one of the whatever first meetings we had, it was a very quick, like 3 months construction because it had to be done before the snow came down. And you see in the back the Mestia village where you have all these old stone towers as kind of protection and storage towers. And of course there's maybe a certain reference from the airport tower to the stone towers there. Here you see this kind of echo. And two other projects that we built there, this is a town hall where you would go, you know, for town hall reasons, or there's also a wedding room in there. So it actually becomes kind of a cultural administrational space in Mestia, and the small police stations also newly built. So the idea of, you know, combining contemporary architecture with an old kind of traditional architecture is quite interesting here. Another project that we just finished about half a year ago are two rest stops in Gori. They're building, Georgia is building a new highway, and you see that kind of in the middle of Georgia running through the first highway ever. And there will be, of course, a series of rest stops. Sometimes they already build rest stops in areas where there is no highway yet, but they become kind of activators or infrastructures for parts of Georgia which also want to, you know, understand that the country is going somewhere. So these rest stops are not only rest stops or gas stations, but they also have a cultural space in there. They have a shopping, like a supermarket, which, you know, is very rarely something that you might find in Georgia. So they bring kind of everyday life to areas where there's hardly any of this kind of support yet. So these buildings are the first two ones built, and you see them when you drive through the first part of the highway. This is the building with, there is a part where you can actually have a farmer's market, there's a supermarket, and there's this cultural space and a restaurant. And each of them are kind of built by different oil companies, whoever runs these rest stops, but they are understood as kind of a contribution of these companies also to the support of the change in Georgia. What was really touching when we were at the opening, this is the second one. It's a little bit of a different construction. Here you have a concrete structure with glass facades. In this case, it's a steel structure that has prefab concrete panels placed on it. One was built by a Turkish company. The other one was built by a Georgian company. But when we came to the opening of this one here, it was interesting that we were told that already three or four couples asked if they could have their marriage celebration in the rest stop. And I think that's quite of a kind of an honor. I was quite touched to hear that. But it also shows how urgently they actually need something new. They want something, which, you know, kind of elevates their everyday life. Because Gori, in this case, actually the hometown of Stalin, is a very kind of rough city still. And these kind of new contemporary architectures are indicators for a change of the country. In Tbilisi, we are also working on a private house that you see up on the little hill. It's next to the president's palace that you see is actually kind of an echo of the German Berlin Reichstag. And the building that you see as the villa at this point is more of a scaffolding. This is a rendering, but the concrete work is mostly done, and now we start to work on the interior. This is all still kind of ephemeral, an old picture here, but you see that it's something that also becomes a discussion in the city, and it was a test. Actually, when we built this one here, we were asked to make it a floor lower because it was too dominant next to the President Palace. And the last one I'm showing you is a structure that is actually going up right now, and it should be finished in 4 weeks. It's a new town that's built for 500,000 people in La Sica. Actually, La Sica didn't exist before. They invented the name. I think it comes from the 4th century, some kind of cultural moment in Georgia. And La Sica is a new town for 500,000 people. Now it's started to be built. And as a, again, kind of an indicator of something that is happening, we were invited to build an arch on the round, the center of a roundabout on the new kind of boulevard. And after a while, we heard that one of the 5 designs that we submitted was accepted. And then a little later, they told us that it will be now placed at the end of the pier in the Black Sea. So kind of placement and design is something that is quite different here. The pier is finished now. This is kind of the preparation for the work. It's this structure, 35 meter high, as an endpoint, maybe kind of a splash in steel to look back and onto the construction of La Sica. So I hope I can show you pictures when it's finished in about 4 to 6 weeks. All this is kind of a warm-up for Metropol Parasol that I'm showing you now. And I think I can talk to you about all the complexities that are part of this project from the very beginning to the, actually until today. Metropol Parasol is the result of a competition that happened in 2004. It was an anonymous competition, everybody could actually participate. And the idea was to find proposals. It was not a realization competition at that point, to find proposals for the central part of downtown, the medieval downtown of Sevilla that you see here is the red spot. Nothing really happened in Seville since the Expo in 1992. So there was a kind of an urge to upgrade the city, to compete with other Spanish cities mostly, and then of course also attract international tourism and business. But this was a very crucial part of the city. It is kind of a egg-shaped medieval downtown, supposedly the largest medieval downtown in Europe. And you see that this very dense fabric has special moments in them. You see the bullfight ring at the upper left, upper right side. You see the cathedral and the town hall, and you know some like plazas or like green areas in this very dense fabric. And you see Metropol Parasol that sits here at the very center of the city center. The site was never kind of a plaza as we know it from Plaza Mayor or Plaza Reals. It was always an institution. There was a cloister there. It became bigger. They ripped out more medieval fabric. It got ripped out again, and it was replaced by a market, which was there till the 1950s, and then it was so rotten because nobody really kind of took care of it that it was taken down in the 70s, finally. Also, the city grew too big to actually feed it from the very center, so that market actually went outside the medieval city center. So what you have now is a place, a heart that was empty and that needed reactivation, kind of needed to be brought back into the everyday life of the city. And you see how crucial the situation, the positioning is at the intersection of all these crossroads through downtown Sevilla. The lower part of this kind of egg-shaped downtown was quite well developed. You have a cathedral, you have the town hall, you have the bullfight ring, all the shopping was there. The northern part in 2004 was a little bit difficult. It was not really dangerous, but it was a little shady. All that kind of changed with a lot of redevelopments and redesign of public spaces. And Metropol Parasol was one of the bridge projects that actually wanted to bring the development of the south into the north part of downtown. This was the situation for the competition. The idea was, after the market was taken down, to build a parking garage 4 stories deep into the earth, then make a plaza and put like a small kind of market, food market in the corner. After they built the 40-meter deep walls into the ground and took out the earth, they found all these Roman ruins, these mosaics, and this kind of, you know, beautiful antique window into the history of the city, that everything stopped, and the city used this moment to rethink what is actually urban space in the 21st century, and what do we want here. the competition was interesting, and I think this was kind of the intelligence of the process, that there was no pressure to find a project really that is supposed to be built. But in the process of the second phase, because the first phase was anonymous, the second phase selected 10 projects, we all had to come to Seville, present our project to each other, but also to the public. There was like public forums. Everything was on the internet, all the texts, all the panels, everything. And this was important to give the opportunity to everybody actually to raise a voice, to question what is going on, and to also follow the discussion. For us, it was important to see, because there was also a forum and a blog on the internet, where we were not sensitive enough or where we could push actually a little further, where we maybe needed ideas of how to program it. The competition was very open. It just said, keep the archaeology as an archaeology museum and bring back some kind of food market functions. All the rest was kind of up to the proposal. Some proposed a park, some proposed high-rises, some proposed a huge kind of cultural machine like Centre Pompidou. We proposed Metropole Parasol. So this was the market which was there before. You see, it was always kind of an object occupying the space. Also, the facades around were not meant to be plaza facades. They were just facades that were street facades all of a sudden becoming exposed to a larger urban space in front of them. Then, when they ripped it down in the 70s, a temporary parking for 30 years, and the food market, the market people had to actually move into the upper right corner into kind of a temporary metal shed structure, and they were one of the biggest supporters to have a project finally happening here to also get a normal kind of market condition again. So here are some of the sketches that we worked on, and I think the initial idea was to create shade, to create a kind of an atmosphere and a climate that allows you to hang out in the public space, to make a lively kind of outdoor public space also in summer. So these are all like step-by-step explorations, how to go after it in a very kind of mixed media way, you know, on computer-generated kind of 3D forms, on real models, on sketches. It was a testing of all kind of media that was available to us. In the end, we came up with this kind of organic roof that had to collect the loads on very specific points because we only were allowed to go into certain areas in the archaeology. That's how these parasols or these stems are created. And then put the other layers of program underneath that one. So when you go from the lower part up, it's an archaeology on the ground floor, in the basement, food market on the ground floor, an elevated plaza as the roof of the market for special events, and then a restaurant in the parasol and the skywalk. Some of the plans, I don't really want to go into detail, but you see everything that's beige on the left drawing needed to be protected. We couldn't do any foundations there. Then the right side drawing shows you the kind of the outline of the market and some other commercial areas. This is the museum in the underground now. You see kind of the careful protection of the walls and the mosaics. And this is a section drawing to give you an idea of the dimension. It's about 35 meters high. It's 150 meters wide and 75 meters wide. So it is quite of a urban scale project. And it's a little higher than the surrounding buildings, so you really have a beautiful view over like the city. And here we have a real model echo of what I'm showing you here from David. These were the initial steps where we tried to understand how we can actually build this proposal in this like one-to-one scale. And what looked so kind of easy at the beginning turned out to be kind of a nightmare. We worked together with Arab engineers and Sasir Isa, the construction company. And step by step, we made a couple of comparisons how to build this. And we compared steel with timber construction, with polyurethane coating, without polyurethane coating, or even glass fiber reinforced concrete. In the end, and in like three different processes, it was always the timber with the polyurethane coating that survived this comparison, or that actually was selected as the best solution. And this includes, you know, parameters like prefabrication, cost development of the material, noise pollution during construction, kind of heat and temperature expansion, contraction behavior, fire issues, earthquake behavior, sound noise, like of like wind sound noise issues. All of these maintenance costs, of course. So all of these components were quite complex to evaluate. But in the design process and in the production process, this was the way to go. But it turned out to be the cause for a much more complex problem, which is the forces in some areas were so high that we had to invent a different kind of detailing. So the stems are okay. They are actually put together with U-shaped metal shoes, basically. But from the moment of the cantilevering on, there's a different detailing that had to be in place. And what you see here is maybe one of the most the kind of complex details in the last few years, where you have these steel joints with metal rods into the wood, but the metal rods are actually glued into the timber. And this had to be the case to transport the loads from the steel to the wood and also to give enough kind of contact. And this is the detail that you have here. It's a metal rod in the center. It's the glue around it. It's the layered timber construction and the polyurethane coating. And this glue, that makes it maybe the largest bond technology or bonding technology building also in the world, holds the whole kind of roof structure together. There was kind of a fear that this glue might not work in temperatures in civil, you know, on a higher degree level. So we made tests, and everything showed that it was actually okay for the 94 centimeters or 96 centimeters. The first 4 centimeters were the critical point. But it worked up to 70 degrees Celsius. And to be on the safe side, you can do a tempering process, which means as soon as the steel details are glued into the wood, you can put the whole element into a chamber and it heats up to 80 degrees, and therefore the performance temperature of the glue also goes up 80 degrees. So we hope now to be safe for at least the next 100 years of climate change, but we should be okay. So some impressions here from the construction phase. You have the concrete towers where the elevators go up. This is because of fire and earthquake issues. We were kind of lucky, and I still don't know if it was true or a political argument. The concrete walls that went down 40 meters had temporary steel anchors. And supposedly the warranty of the steel anchors were running out. And the city feared that the walls would start to move and therefore the houses around would get cracks. And this helped us to actually start with the construction even less than a year after we won the competition with the big foundations. It created certain problems because we assumed a specific load for these foundations. Therefore, in the end, later on, we couldn't put more load on it. So the whole design of the construction afterwards had to be kind of fitted to the load-bearing qualities of the foundations. But in the end, it helped us to start much earlier, while the problems came a little later. That's a different process than what we would actually experience in Germany, and then in the end, maybe with the fear that it would not get built. So there was kind of a good energy at the very beginning, and you see all the way to the end, it has to it has a certain spatial quality also to see this thing going up in a way very traditional, you know, with the scaffolding like in old cathedral constructions. You have this kind of echo of old and new. This is, I think, also the special quality of this project, that it does this dialogue with the context and the surrounding. Here are some impressions at night from the archaeology up into the roof structure. The shadow, that is such an important element, that also changes, you know, in different parts of the year and different parts of the day. Here's like a gridded structure, and then it becomes more of a spline shadow here. And when you look at it from the sky, this is a Bing map. It's hardly visible, which is kind of amazing to see. So what actually kind of was the rewarding part is to see how we were facing a lot of criticism, but also a lot of support, mostly from a kind of a younger generation and also kind of an older generation. It was more like the middle-aged people who were more doubtful. But since it opened, it's amazing to see how it got kind of accepted and actually really embodied and embraced by the city and the kind of the everyday life in all kinds of aspects. I'm showing you this one because it really shows that it's a digital project. It's the orthogonal grid, you know, the east, north, east, west, north, south kind of grid that is materialized within this invisible organic shape of metropole parasol. And the conflict then, you know, happens where this invisible to material happens. So this kind of surfboard that you see hanging there actually still made it right into the materiality rather than, you know, jumping out into the invisible. This one you wouldn't design if you would design it kind of in a traditional way by hand. So these kind of conflicts are quite nice to see in small details like this one here. This is when you go up onto the roof. It's a skywalk. And you have this beautiful view onto the city. There's, I think, a hidden life where you have these gardens and swimming pools, and you kind of get a view and a feeling what this city actually, how this vibrates. And at night, it's open until midnight or even longer. You really see the whole kind of light conditions of the city. But it really gets part of the routines and the rituals. One strong kind of critical part of the city were the Catholics, you know, who are like serious Catholics, and who wanted to protect their old downtown. They have the Semana Santa, which is the Catholic processions the week before Easter. And it was interesting to see that this year they even put it up on their cover. So it cannot be so bad anymore if they use it as an advertisement for their Semana Santa. This is how it happens. It's a very special moment. The city is very quiet. It's full with people. Hardly people talk. What you hear is the breathing of the people who have to carry these really heavy floats with all these different religious sculptures. And there's a very strange music that they also play with it. Of course, there's a website, so they also like communicate now the program via the social media. And as we heard before, it got used to all kinds of different music videos. This is a very cheesy, you know, kind of Latino song singer. But also it happened to be in a hip-hop video. Again, another cheesy other version where, you know, it gets... And then you have also the public viewing for the World Soccer Games, where it was like really kind of packed and full with people. It was also part of an action movie with like a shooting, and Gay Pride, you know, celebrated there as much as the cartoon festival, the comic festival used it, you know, as their introduction in the posters. So appropriation really happened, and also it became kind of a symbol for a modern kind of surprisingly, while the kind of the revolution, the indignados kind of criticized the old regime of Spain as not taking care of the youth, this project kind of survived and jumped into the other side to be kind of a symbol for a modern Spain. So they used it for hearings, for discussion groups, also for demonstrations and concerts, and also at night for their sleeping place. And I think that's a proof that a city really can make a project like this as a gift to their citizens, to create a space that envelopes them, that embraces them, that allows citizens to really feel part of the dynamic, and giving them a ground, a place to meet and celebrate this communal life. And this is how I would like to end the project. It's about how a personal obsession, when you follow it, actually can turn into something that also touches other people. Thank you very much.
Really amazing. Thank you very much, Jürgen, for this very provocative. It was inspiring and intense lecture. Thank you very much. So we're going to take some questions. We do have a few questions, you don't mind? Yeah? So we're going to take a few questions for Jürgen. I know you guys got a lot of information here.
Hello. Thank you for the lecture. I'm actually very interested in the detailing for the last project, where you showed us the part with the glue and the steel inside of the wood. Can you maybe elaborate more on this? Thank you.
there would be an engineer, a better person to talk to you about this. What I know is that we had to find a way to bring the loads deeper into the timber, because it would have the load just kind of pressure on the edges, it would melt away like butter. So you would have to actually distribute it into a larger field of the wood. What I know is that the steel has to have like a lower quality than the glue, because if something breaks, it has to be the steel and not the glue somehow. And it had to be, well, the glue is on the market for about 5 years now, so it was actually a very new innovation developed by the Fraunhofer Institute in Germany, which is a material research institute. So we weren't really sure like what the performance qualities of this glue were, so we had to actually make the tests with fire, you know, tests, but also with the temperature performance limits of the glue. And it all worked out well. So we have some sprinklers on the outside. That's more part of the polyurethane coating in areas where we have escape routes on the ground floor. But the bonding happens where we have to go into the horizontal cantilevering part. There's not much more to tell you about this, but it actually took us a while. And there were a lot of meetings where the engineers and the construction companies talked. I was at a couple of them, and I actually didn't follow all of the discussions. They talked about like micro omega parameters, whatever, you know, which was a big drama, which didn't sound important to me, but it was actually serious. So that's why it took actually quite a long time to figure out how to build, how to find the right detailing for the structure ups, like the structure for the parasol itself.
You said you had talked about using either concrete or glue or steel. In the original design intent, was material not really something that informed the design at all? Like, where did you want a homogeneous surface from the get-go, and it wouldn't have mattered what material it was? Or were you planning on changing the design based on what the material criteria was in the end?
What I see as a different approach is when we deal with, let's say, smaller objects, like a seat, a furniture piece, or like more of an object, we usually start with the material and think about what are the potentials of that material. When we do architecture, it actually happens to be the other way around. Like, we work on the spatial qualities and maybe the atmospheric qualities and then find the right material to realize that. Usually that forces us, the kind of this ignorance in the design process of the materiality forces us to be super innovative, to find ways how to build it with the engineers and with the client, of course, and with the specialists and the construction companies. But this is how we actually come up with these new construction solutions, when you would have to find something that works within the budget, something that works also as the performance of the construction and the maintenance and everything like that. Actually, the design changed from the competition to the realization, and I'm happy about it, because in the design phase, I wasn't really kind of satisfied. It was a radial steel structure with kind of paillettes sitting on top of it. So in a way, it was built, the skin was built, or let's say the outer shape of this parasol was built. And but this was the only way we could actually propose it with the engineers. And then when we won, thank God we had the time to actually rethink that structure. And so it moved from building the skin to actually building the volume inside, and the skin became invisible. And I think that actually helped us to be very kind of flexible and elastic when it came to adjustments in, let's say, construction thicknesses, in the dimensions, also in the discussions with the landmark department, where we had to be kind of lower in certain areas or could go higher, you know, according to the skyline around it. So it was a kind of a helpful step to make that shift from building the definition of the form to the inside of the form. What I didn't show, and this is kind of wrong in this model here, it's not the same thickness of the concrete of the timber plates. Actually, we have more load. They come up to like 28 centimeters thickness. At the end, they are at the edges. They are like 7 centimeters. So the forces that are actually running not along the the orthogonal lines, but they're more kind of let's say a diagonal or a centrifugal force line, actually make also the fine-tuning of the grid into thicker and thinner plates.
Okay, so it was quite impressive lecture, and I got some question turning back to the beginning. You mentioned something about fluidity and the continuity. It's like, how do you usually, because usually architects define continuity as like a continuity of the space, and some architects define it like as continuity of the continue building envelope. But how did you define this notion of continuity in your project?
There are different versions. I think it's like a continuity that of certain ideas or construction methods that jump from one project to the other, and they get kind of developed and further pushed. Or it's a, let's say, a continuity of the indoor, like the outside condition into the inside condition of a building. I think it depends on the project you talk about. But it's, in a way, it's not only that the continuity, but it's also the kind of the problems along that transition from one condition to the other that are interesting, and how to define these steps or how to actually modulate these steps along a, let's say, a continuous, the ruptures within the continuity, actually.
One or two more questions. Okay, I just wanted to ask you, the cafe, the sketches that you had done in Georgia that ended up being built and then the design mimicked on the building across the street, is there any kind of intellectual property issues there? Were you able to, was there any, I don't know, restitution from the government, or was it, since you've ended up with multiple other projects in the country, it wasn't really a big deal?
Well, this was the first one, so I didn't know that it, you know, was kind of a minor issue in the longer history of our collaborations. But basically, that's what I told them. Like, if you want to become a contemporary country, like a Western country, that's what the country wants to be, then, you know, property, like, rights have to be implied. And they took it quite serious. I mean, they were kind of, it was an embarrassing moment, yeah. But, I mean, in the end, I was... What can you do? I mean, I was angry first, then I started laughing about it, then I didn't care, then I was angry again, so I went through like different phases. I got a little bit of money like later, but you know, at some point maybe that happens. I took it as a sign of honor in the end.
My question is, how much compromise do you have to deal with? Is there times when you come up to a dead end and people are telling you, no, it can't be done, and there is no innovative solution to go to make your design a reality? Do you ever have to go back to the drawing board?
Going back, maybe it's not the right definition, but you send, I mean, you constantly like work in dialogue. It's not that you design something and that's it, you know. It's, at some point, it's a proposal that starts, if you finish the design, it's a proposal to start negotiating what is possible. And so far, we were lucky to find people on board, including the client, which you always need as your accomplice, you know, to actually create these kind of architectures of, let's say, adventuring spaces or something like that. So far, we were quite lucky to make the buildings as we want them to. But maybe the way we want them also happened along the way when we discussed how to build it. I can't remember a moment where we had to say, like, no, this is not possible. So, but maybe that's also part of that we know how far we can push certain things to keep them still in the realm of making them a reality. I think there's some kind of a knowledge that you build up and you know how far you can push certain things.
Great. So, Jürgen, thank you so much. Thank you for coming to us tonight, and please know that you are always welcome back here in Montreal at the first opportunity. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.